Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you in a conversation that is being recorded on the 5th of September, 2017. Although this conversation has been in the works for a couple of years now. That was when I first got in touch with Jeffrey Tucker about this conversation that I wanted to have about his then relatively new book called Bit by Bit. Of course, the link for that book will be in the show notes for this, but you can reach Jeffrey Tucker and see all of his writing at fee.org. That's F-E-E.org. Jeffrey Tucker, thank you for coming on. It's good to finally have you here.
Right. And it's not bad that we've waited this long, because everything in the book is still massively relevant. You know, it may be not as prophetic, but...
That's right. With each passing year, it gets more sort of transparently obvious. But it was good to say that you were there at the bleeding edge. And this might be a good...
I remember writing about this topic in 2013 and facing, you know, torrents of ridicule, you know, so...
And I've been talking about it for at least that long as well, and I think it is an exceptionally important thing, and I know it's a good, maybe, relief from the intellectual and spiritual drudgery of going through all the right Hegelianism philosophy that you're dredging yourself into right now. I know it is not easy going, so I'll give you a bit of a break from that. And I, just for the record, for people watching the video version of this interview, I did consider dressing up for this interview, but then I realized I knew you would, no matter what I dressed as, you would outdress me, so I decided to go the other way. They say if you can't dress up, then at least dress interesting, so I'm wearing my Doyle's of College Green Dublin shirt.
Which
Very
is nice.
A memento of the only pub that I have ever been barred for life from. So,
that sounds like there's a story there.
Just a mix-up with a bouncer and silliness, but all part of the fun of being in Dublin. I actually went back the next day to get this shirt, so didn't quite take the way they thought it would. All right, let's get into this conversation. Let's set the stage for people this way. The word... or the words, the market, have become so tainted in the popular vernacular that it is almost in and of itself used in a pejorative fashion these days, that you are a supporter of the market. Because, of course, as we know, the market is populated by people who just want to extract every last penny from you. They're vultures, predatory vultures that are just preying on you and will sell their own grandmother to make a profit. And that's what the market is. You present an idea of the market that is quite refreshingly different from that. So let's try. I know there are people in the audience who already have their intellectual blinkers up, but let's try and show them what the market really is and really can be, the different way of looking at it.
Okay. I mean, to me, the market is just the space of freedom in which people serve each other and acknowledge each other's value and dignity. I mean, that's it. Cooperating together to make the world a better place. And that's all it is. Everything else is incidental. You know, the money, accounting mechanisms, workers and payrolls, bosses, and so on. All those are just institutionally incidental. What it really is about human service, and that's the first point. The second one is that it's about discovery, because we can combine our knowledge and learn from each other to invent new ways of making the best of the resources we have and discovering things that we ourselves don't know and that nobody knows individually, but together we can come together, we can share knowledge and find out ways to make the world a better place.
Yes. Okay, yes, perfect. Let's stop there. Hayek and the idea of spontaneous order, such a fundamentally important thing to understand, that not only is it a question that society can be, or can be ordered this way, or we should order it this way, it's that no individual has the knowledge to be able to order society, and that is a good thing, because it means we actually need to work together with other human beings and serve their interests in order to discover the best way to order society, if you want to put it in that framework, break that down for us. Tell us a little bit more about
that. Well, let me give a slight example of this that maybe people can relate to. If you've ever been really in love with somebody before, and that third or fourth date comes around where you're starting to think, this person's really improving my life, you know? And you somehow the hours are like minutes, you know, and whole evenings fly by where you're just sitting curled up on the sofa talking about whatever, movies, food, music, childhood, your parents, you know, the glories of living in Colorado or the time you both traveled to Florida on spring break. But what you find in a really great conversation, and a conversation that's animated by love, is that you know more coming out of it, not just because you took their information, and she knows, or your partner knows more, and not just because he or she took your information, it's because you combined your knowledge to discover new things that you didn't know before. And that's a magical thing to happen. And those kinds of conversations are beautiful. And it's not like anyone can say, oh, I took that from you or you took that from me. It's that you both had a bit of it and you combined these information bits together to arrive at a new consensus. And you leave both transformed. And it's hard to explain what that means. You know, it's like, I love you. I feel different since I've been with you. I feel like I know new things. You've taught me so much. And then your partner says, I don't know what you could possibly mean by that. I'm the beneficiary of you. I feel like I've learned so much. And you're like, well, you didn't learn it from me. Well, it turns out this only happened because of the combined information that melded together, that, you know, information having sex, basically, and producing a new thing that otherwise wouldn't have existed. Okay, so we've all been in those kinds of relationships. So imagine that kind of relationship expanded out over thousands and millions and billions of people, turned into a 24/7 conversation that never stops. That's the essence of the market process of information sharing. Like, we're constantly getting better and learning from each other because of our communications with each other. And these don't have to take place on a sofa either. They can take place just by the things you observe, you know, in the world and the world happening around you, which entice you to imagine new possibilities and then acting on those new possibilities. And through this process of information sharing and generation, we actually kick the world into a kind of progressive motion. We create the forward direction of history itself, you know, all through the information capital we have.
Here I was expecting you to go the Leonard Reed eye pencil route, and you take it in a whole different direction. But that's a beautiful way of putting it, because it puts the emphasis on the fact that we are... we learn from each other. We cannot learn in a vacuum. We learn from being and interacting with other human beings. And that also means that it isn't a hierarchical system where there are certain people who are floating on clouds who can see everything and they have to teach, you know, the people at the bottom. It's that everybody has a part to play in this. And that's what the market is. People coming in and bringing their information, their experience, their everything, and bringing that to other people and finding ways to get along and interact.
And you said, oh, we went on to talk about right Hegelianism here. And you're right. But let me just say that the tendency of politics now to tribalize people is extremely dangerous, actually. It's like, I only want to be around and talk to white people. You know, I'm sick of men. Men are all misogynists and evil. The last thing I need is some crazy Sharia law practicing Muslim in my community, and so on and so on. I mean, these kinds of attitudes, which you find really on the right and the left, are extremely dangerous for the progress of humanity, because we all need each other. I mean, like, when I say all, I mean all of us need all of us. Every human being is an asset. Every human being, no matter how stupid or dumb or men or women or black or white or Islam or Jewish or, you know, doesn't matter. We all have value because we have human minds that are creative, and we have knowledge localized knowledge of time and place that means something to our own lives. And the market permits us to bring that knowledge to others in a way that can be valued by other people. And that valuing and exchange that takes place is what builds this macro structure that's so much bigger and more than the sum of all the individual parts. And you mentioned by pencil. This is Leonard Reed's point that nobody can build a pencil. I mean, it's another way of expressing the same thing. Alone, we are desperately poor. And we live hopeless lives that are short and are desperately impoverished. But together, we can thrive and build great lives for ourselves. And the more together we are, the better our lives can be. So anything, as Adam Smith said, anything that expands the division of labor, which is another way of saying anything that expands the scope of human cooperation, is good for society and good for prosperity and good for humanity.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'd last by myself in the woods for about 13 and a half minutes before probably being eaten by a pack of wolves or something. So I can very much appreciate that point. And I think, absolutely, let me echo what you said about the tribalism and the dangers of that at this current political moment with something that I saw recently online. I was, of all things, looking in the YouTube comment section. Not of my own YouTube comments, but on another video. And I can't remember the context of the video.
Always dangerous.
Yeah, always dangerous. But I can't remember the exact context, but it was about a man in the video who was having problems with his family or something like that. And people were speculating, you know, why were these problems happening? And someone had pointed out that, oh, his children are mixed race. They're not the same as him. And because people have a hard time getting on with people of a different race, he must not relate well to his children. So myself, as a man in Japan, living married to a Japanese woman with half Japanese children, read that comment and realizing this is some 16-year-old or something who's read this online, oh, you know, races don't mix and they don't get along. So this father must not care about his children because they are not the same race as he is, not the same ethnicity, is so ridiculous. So stupid, and yet it's so sad that people are being drawn into this, especially because the point you're making here is that we do need all of us together in order to combat the very real problems that are happening today that are not coming from each other. They are coming from the statist system of control that wants to tribalize us, that wants to divide and conquer us. And this relates very well to a point that you make in Bit by Bit, How P2P is Freeing the World. You say the biggest, grandest illusion of all is that people can't run their own lives because they are too stupid and powerless, but these same people are smart enough to be given the power to choose others to run their lives for them. Yes, that old canard. You are stupid. You are powerless. You have to be divided against your neighbor. And you have to give your power to someone above you, the government, in order to run your life for you. Talk about the danger of that mentality that people have adopted to a large extent without even realizing they're adopting it.
Well, what it means is that everything you do, you have to have permission. That you're not actually exercising volition anymore under those conditions. All you're doing is begging somebody to act, to speak, to think. And we as human beings don't function well that way. We're structured to be individual actors in our own interest. And we need systems that make that kind of action benefit others. It really began about 100 years ago when we, you know, as societies began to implement these intermediating forces. You know, the constantly said, you and I can't deal with each other without obeying some external coercive power that tells us, you know, whether or not I can make a contract with you. And it was a disaster, really. It all began in the Progressive Era, essentially. I mean, like in the 1890s, you never would have had any, there was no conditions under which I couldn't be hired by you at any price that we agreed upon. By 1920, it was very common that was no longer true. You know, now we had to obey an external force that said, well, here's the right wage, here's got to be the conditions, the working hours, and here's how long you can work and how, you know. And that begins to sort of gum up the works a lot. And then society becomes inadaptive and it gets glued down and stagnant. And we're stagnating our economies today with these approaches that are really an anachronism. I mean, we have the technology now to create gradually a full-blown peer-to-peer world, a completely disintermediated world of commerce and exchange and creativity. And we're not doing it, and we cannot do it as fully as we want to because of this gigantic legacy content of huge states that are demanding we always move through them. It's true almost every area of our lives, you know, innovations and our financial lives, our monetary lives, our trade relationships, speech, you name it, you know. And to me, this is all just kind of like wicked historical overhang, you know. I think maybe you mentioned that you've written code in the past. You know, what you have to do when you have a well-functioning program is you have to clean out bad code before the new code works properly. And it's called cruft, which I like. You know, you have to get rid of the cruft for the thing to work right. And so many ways the massive states that we created 100 years ago and that just grew gradually over time, they're just cruft that are standing in the way of our innovation. They can't stop us entirely from progressing, but they can slow us down, and they have.
Well, I think you hit on one of the fundamental points here that I mean, I guess to bring it back to the old economic debates, the means and factors of production in any given era determine to a large extent the social and political structures that arise from that era. So there is a sense in which we can understand, even if it wasn't necessary, at any rate, I can understand how the Industrial Revolution era and the factories and the centralization of production in those areas created the systems that led to governments, central governments with that kind of control. Whatever the validity of that or lack thereof, at any rate, we are not in that era anymore. And I think people still fail to grasp just how completely decentralized and disaggregated all of these formerly centralized production processes are becoming. Paint the picture. What kind of technologies are we talking about here?
What happened with the creation of the blockchain was the greatest single technological advance, I would say, possibly ever, but certainly since the printing press, and maybe since papyrus, you know. You know, it's really interesting, James, to me, because when Bitcoin came out, people thought it was a kind of an internet money. I thought this, right? I thought, well, this is an money created on the internet. And I thought, well, that can't work, and it did work. And I thought, that's weird. Why does it work? So I noticed that it has all these properties of money. But as the years have gone on, I'm realizing more profoundly every day that money is an application of blockchain technology, but that the technology itself is the bigger and more robust and profound thing. And so you might say, okay, what does that technology do? And if I were going to sum it up, I put it in this phrase. It enables us to more precisely define, identify, and document our rights claims that we make over what is ours, and allows us to then observe what rights claims you're making for yourself over what is yours, and therefore have more fluid and peaceful relationships with each other. That's what blockchain technology actually does. And, you know, if we had had a blockchain in the 2000s, the 2008 financial crisis never would have happened, because we would have understood more clearly who owns these mortgages, what are the risk ratings of these bonds, how can we unbundle these things, or how can we price these instruments, these financial instruments, in a way that's more realistic. So the boom wouldn't have happened, and the bust wouldn't have happened. And even if the boom and bust had happened, then we could have easily sorted it out afterwards. But we literally did not have the technology to do that. We were using old-fashioned databases, centralized databases, right? But now with the blockchain, we have a ledger system that exists in the cloud that's, in effect, owned and observed by the entire world. And that is going to bring a new level of peace, clarity, rationality, and coherence to our functioning as human beings that we've never seen before. So just so we understand how important this is, I mean, there's basically two stages to exiting a life of suffering and war and entering into a life of peace and productivity, right? The first one is to discover a method for dealing with the existence of scarcity in the world. There's not enough to go around. We can continue to beat each other up, or we can have a system of assigning ownership rights and then trading with each other and finding out that if I do what I'm good at and you do what you're good at, then we can trade our property back and forth in peace and both be better off. Okay, that was an immense discovery. That was the greatest discovery in the history of humanity. It probably happened about 150,000 years ago. We don't know when. That was awesome. But there's a second stage, and that is you have to have some way to document your claims so that your production structures can become more sophisticated, and so they can be understood by a broader community over time. So it's not just verbal. This is my garden. These are my mules. This is my patch of blueberries or whatever, but rather we have some way for the community to observe who's claiming what and when it happened and how that property was transferred. And this is extremely important for that second stage of civilizational development. So throughout history, we've always had methods of documenting rights claims. Probably the first one was in stone, and then we figured out how to do it with clay. And we've had all kinds of schemes for doing this over time. And then it was papyrus, and then it was parchment, and then by the time of the Medicis, they were using, this awesome stuff called vellum, very expensive, but also very precise and preserved records. So you could understand what was going on, so you could make sense of a chaotic world. And then when the printing press came along, that was an amazing advance. And then the next advance was basically the invention of the database in the 1970s, right? And that's what we've lived up to now. But the problem with all of these systems is that they have to be managed from a centralized location, meaning that it opens up possibilities of fraud, deception, and failure. What Satoshi Nakamoto did with the release of the Genesis block in January of 2009, was revealed to the world a new way of doing what humanity has always wanted to do, which is to document ownership claims that we all make for ourselves and others in a way that everybody that could achieve a certain social assent, right? He did that within a technology that is completely decentralized and allows for the for immutable claims, so that the history never goes away. And that's awesome. So just imagine the possibility of taking any bundle of information, which is hard to bundle, but once you get it bundled, and be able to port it as if it was in a transparent glass sphere from me to any other person in the world, right? And a weightless form that takes up no space, and that information packet can be opened up, read and understood exactly as it was given in an immutable form. and consumed and understood in that way. That's what the blockchain does.
It's still difficult to get our minds around just how much of our society, our economy, has been structured around this idea that we need middlemen to be the centralized verification of various processes.
Right.
How many jobs, I mean, what are we talking about in terms of eliminating that need from society? I don't mean in the sense of how many jobs are we going to lose, but I mean these functions that really are just these central servers or whatever that we trust, that are the trusted things that act as the middleman in our economy, that really are useless in the blockchain era.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, we first started getting a glimpse of what P2P engagement was like. Okay, let's just be clear that we've always engaged peer-to-peer, but it's always been contingent upon geography, right? There had to be geographic contiguous geography, right? So I had to be standing next to you to engage in peer-to-peer transactions. With the internet, we started seeing the first glimpse of the possibility of having a geographically non-contiguous peer-to-peer engagements. And things like, what was that file sharing service that came and went in
Napster?
1999? Napster, right? So that was a first glimpse of, wow, I can share my stuff with anybody in the world and they can share their stuff with me, and it was amazing. Then we started seeing it in the retail market, things like eBay, which, you know, is a platform, but basically it's peer-to-peer. I mean, I can put somebody up on eBay and you can buy it, you know, and that was awesome. So we started seeing the possibilities of this emerge in the retail sector. But there was always one big sort of hang-up, namely that we never had a peer-to-peer money. And money is important because it's just a proxy for goods and services and a means of accounting, essentially. It's a way for us to engage with each other in a way that facilitates exchange better than pure barter. But we didn't have a means of having a money that was also peer-to-peer. So with Bitcoin, we actually saw a glimpse of what could happen there. But it was just the beginning. If you can have peer-to-peer relationships that involve every manner of contract that you can possibly conceive of, whether insurance claims or inheritance or land rights, titles to cars, marriage licenses, copyright claims, you know, whatever it is, if you could have systems that basically cover the whole of our lives insofar as they involve dealing with other people, which is actually pretty much the whole of our lives, you completely upend the structure of world economies and cultures and the function of the social order itself. And that sounds like a crazy claim, but it's actually not. I mean, we are literally right now living in the early days of the birth of a new world. Nothing will ever be the same. This technology is never going away.
Well, that sounds like a promise, but such promises can also sound like a ominous warning to some. And I think there's a sort of the easy to dismiss silly version of the argument and then the more profound argument. So I think the silly version of the argument is, well, I mean, for example, I just saw the headline that Ben Bernanke just gave a talk about the blockchain and how important it is. So if these critters are pumping it up, then clearly it must be.
That's funny.
I think to go back to your earlier analogy, if this is like the printing press or something like that, I mean, it's like saying, well, the government uses a printing press, therefore the printing press is evil. It's kind of a silly way of arguing.
So I don't really, none of this stuff really means anything to me. I mean, I have a friend of mine who works in blockchain technology who gave the first presentation at the Federal Reserve about Bitcoin. And it's just her description of this is so funny. So she's going to the Board of Governors, right? And she's heading a team of three or four developers who are now introducing, who's the head of the Fed now? What's her name?
Yellen.
Yellen. Janet. Yeah, introducing Yellen to Bitcoin and other members of the board. And these people are not, I mean, you know, they're Fed people. They don't know anything about, like, technology and stuff. I mean, you know, they're living in the 80s and 90s.
I think Yellen doesn't know much about blockchain.
So they had a couple of computers, you know, plugged in with screens, and you know, smartphones and that kind of stuff. And my friend made a donation to the Red Cross or something like that, or whatever the thing was at the time, or maybe it was to Wikipedia or something. And they watched it take place on the blockchain in real time. And Yellen and all the other members of the Federal Reserve were just like, their jaws were on the floor. They're like, what just happened? You know, like, how did that, you know, is this ACH? You know, is this, you know, what bank did that go through? You know, they simply could not even believe it. They couldn't understand it. And it wasn't possible in that one session to even get them anywhere near the point where they could even understand it. And this was a couple of years ago now. And so all these old bureaucrats are, you know, desperately trying to learn what's what. And it's kind of embarrassing, really, but it's also kind of fun. So yeah, the Fed. No, here's the thing. Nobody's happy with the way things are working now. I mean, the least of which, you know, the Fed. I mean, the Fed knows that its technology for moving money from here to there is ridiculously outmoded, absurdly insecure, and very expensive. But it's expensive for them too, and they know that there's a serious problem that needs fixing. But the problem is that they're not in a position to invent that technology, much less manage it. That is taking place outside of all the official channels, not in a top-down form, but in a bottom-up form. So they are in the position of learning and watching, which makes them very uncomfortable. I remember the early days of email, and nobody remembers this, but early email used to be really revolutionary. Like, you just can't believe you can actually send an email. It's like, what? I remember the first time I had email explained to me, I didn't even understand why this was important. Because we used to use modems back and forth, right? You would call the person and say, I'm going to call you my modem. And then, you know, you connect, and then you'd miss the call. Hello? Oh, hang up now. It was chaos. And I had a friend call me and tell me, well, there's this new thing called email where you can just leave you whatever information you want in some location. And then at somebody else's leisure, they can sort of dial in and pick up that information. And I said, well, where does it go in the meantime? And he said something like, I don't know, like a box in the sky or something. And I said, that sounds a little suspicious. And I said, besides, it seems completely unnecessary. How would the person even know to pick up that information? And my friend said to me, well, probably you should just call him and tell him. And I said, well, if I'm going to call him and tell him about this great email, why don't I just send it to him? He goes, well, that makes a good point, actually, a good point. And so I just rejected the idea of email. Of course, that shows the lack of human imagination, right? But when email really took off, the post office said, well, it's an intolerable situation that surely nobody will stand for, that all these private companies are in email. We are the U.S. Post Office, and we are going to be the official email people. So they put little machines in post office all over the country called Postal Buddy, which are like these weird, scary, you know, boxes with faces. I mean, ugh. And you're supposed to go to them and like register. So you give like your name, your social security number, your official address, and I don't know, your birth certificate, I don't know what. Then they issue, you know, a special number, you know, at, you know, post.org or whatever the thing was. And they put them in post offices all over the country and were amazed to see. And the postmaster general was certain that these things were going to take off, because who trusts private enterprise in the end, really? And he said this in a speech. He said, nobody's going to trust all this nonsense, these private companies, you know, doing this stuff. They're only going to trust us because we're official. And well, nobody did it. I mean, they sat in the offices for 6 months, and it was an absolute humiliation. They gathered dust, and they finally just broke down and took them in, threw them in the dumpster. And that was the end of the official. So I feel this. It's the same situation with central banks and cryptocurrency, you know? I don't know. We have
Bitcoin. It's better than that Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, they can do it. They can do it, but there's no reason for anybody to use their coin as versus...
Well, this is the point. And blockchains can be used in ways that blockchains aren't meant to be used in, so that they are centralized and permissioned, and that, you know, they're used by a bank for internal whatever. They can be used in that way, but that's not what the technology is about. So
that's right. There's public token blockchains and purely private blockchains. You know, exactly. And there are many of both. And I don't know, you know, you and I can't say for sure what this technology is going to look like in the future. I mean, I don't think 3 years ago anybody had any notion of Ethereum, or maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, certainly nobody did. And you know, the what a kind of powerful tool that would be for the development of all these applications. I'm an advisor to a company named Factome that specializes in property registrations, mostly in Latin America. And it was really powerful because, you know, you've been living in a house for 20 years and then somebody knocks on your door and says, get out of here, this is my house. Well, how are you gonna fight against that claim if you have no documentation? So this company Factome, which has a public token called Factoid, it just registers property, you know, on the blockchain. So at least you have some documentation of that. So, you know, this is just one of a gazillion applications, and you bump into them every day. I mean, you probably do this too. I spend a lot of my time reading white papers. And I mean, all the ideas are really interesting, and you can't know in advance, like, which ones are going to really catch on and which ones are going to be lame. You know, we just don't know.
Well, okay, but that brings us to, I think, the more robust criticism of this world that's coming into view, which is the idea that sometimes you do know which white papers are going to take off, and it's not because of the value of the ideas, it's because of the value of the monetary bank accounts of the people pushing certain ideas, funding them into existence, pushing technologies this way or that. Which brings us to the question, when a technology that is potentially revolutionary and decentralizing, like blockchain, many others as well, 3D printing and things like this, when these systems develop within the framework of a centralized and ordered society, they run the risk of becoming tools of oppression. So that the idea of the immutable and unchangeable recording of everything that is being done and databased and logged for all eternity is potentially, if it is used in the wrong way, the absolute ultimate pinnacle of nightmare Orwellian totalitarian control and insight into everything that everyone is doing. And what dictator throughout history would not have killed, obviously, for that ability, that technology, which is now here. Now we have that.
Yeah, and it's true enough. But, you know, I don't think that blockchain information technology is different from other technologies in history. I mean, when the crossbow was invented and when the first guns came out, you know, that really seriously empowered individuals and gave them, for the first time, the ability to secure their own lives against the state, against private criminals. You know, somebody might have come along and said, you know, this is a catastrophe. Someday, government's going to get a really big gun and blow up millions of people, you know? Well, that's true, and that's bad. But if the alternative is not to progress, then I don't think that's a choice we want to face. I mean, with every technology, there's always a danger that it's going to be taken by the wrong people and used for the wrong purposes. And that speaks to really my own ideological orientation. To me, the way to prevent against this eventuality is not through shutting down technological development, but it's through the abolition of the state. I'll just put it that way. Just, I think if we get rid of states, I think, is the worst technology we ever invented. It only lives through coercion and compulsion. If there are market tests for states, they would have just been weeded out long ago. So at least we need to restrain the state as much as possible. And I think that's the only politics worth engaging in, is that which restricts the power of the state in every area, in culture and society, economy and trade and migration, every single area. There's no exception. The state's power has to be restrained or abolished to make the world really safe.
Yeah, amen to that. And that, I think, is clearly, people who are using Bitcoin or whatever in ways that are empowering or helping the state or going along and, oh yes, I will register, you know, 17 ways in order to get on this exchange in order to do this properly and then, you know, account for it in my taxes. That's the entire point of why this technology exists and why it should be being used in very different ways than they're telling you to use it in.
Yeah, there, you know, there's all these moves to make Bitcoin and blockchain technology act as if it were an old technology that actually it's intended to get rid of, you know? So it's a matter of like pounding these square pegs into round holes or vice versa.
It's about how you use it. And that comes back to the consciousness. If you are using it consciously for a reason to participate in the Agora, then you have incentive to use it in ways different than what they're telling you to use it in. And that brings out the power of the technology, what it was actually.
The whole thing is very embarrassing to me as like an actual human person to watch the way states are treating this technology right now. I mean, in 50 years, 100 years, people are going to look back and go, what were they thinking? The greatest thing ever came out. And instead of just embracing it, they tried to regulate it, restrain it, control it, demonize it. You know, hound people, drive people out of the markets, you know, try to fit it into the old way. It's a little bit like, you know, when internal combustion came along to try to, you know, force it to work like, you know, force a gas-powered tractor to make cloppy sounds like horses or something. You know, I mean, that's pretty much the way states are behaving towards blockchain technology. But it's not going to last. I mean, it's certainly not going to last.
The cat is out of the bag. I mean, the cat is out of the bag. You can... Physically, it is possible to go and 3D print a gun right now. It can be done. But the Supreme Court and the US DOJ won't let you put the plans for how to do that online. Just ask Cody Wilson. That is impossible. But you can physically do it. So there's a bit of a tension there.
Well, there's going to be plenty of plans online today. And it was so interesting because Cody Wilson was told to take down his plans. And he's like, okay, well... There are already thousands of versions of the gun. And actually, within 24 hours, the gun was already improved, you know. And since that time...
Open source 3D printed guns.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing about technology is that it's a lot more powerful than any politician or any regime. Regimes do all kinds of crazy things. I mean, in American history, don't forget, it was in something like 1920, somebody came up with the idea... that the real problem with the world is that people are drinking liquor. So let's add an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that says that there will be no consumption or production of liquor in the United States. And that will take care of everything, right? Yeah, that'll solve all problems. Well, it didn't last because it couldn't last. And we created chaos, you know, and eventually it had to go away. So that's what all these regulations trying to control information flows are like. I mean, they're really no different from that stupid constitutional amendment that tried to get you from drinking a beer, you know? Yeah. I don't care. You have all the power, all the parchment, you know, every parliament, every president, you know, and everybody's in vain against this or that. Technology is more powerful. It's just their bullets just can't kill ideas, no matter what they do.
That's a good point, yeah. And I think, we should probably stress that era a little bit more. Prohibition, what a ridiculous concept. It was guaranteed to fail. It failed because the government can't stop. When the mass of people want to do something, they're going to do it. And no parchment or magic hat is going to make people stop doing that.
Right. I mean, in my lifetime, Richard Nixon got on national television and swore that he would eliminate marijuana, you know, from sea to shining sea. You know, it's going away. That's it. No more marijuana.
Yeah, indeed.
That didn't work.
All right. Well, I've already held you over our allotted 30 minutes, so I'll let you go. But just to summarize our conversation, would it be fair to say that the state is outdated? It is already a dinosaur. It just hasn't realized it yet.
Yeah, it's an anachronism. It's unfortunately a very dangerous one, though, right now, because what we're seeing arise both in the U.S. and Europe are these kind of small ideological juntas that are trying to get access to the power to ruin our lives, and it's the left. You know, it's the right, it's the theocrats. I mean, you name the group. I mean, there's all these people vying to control the state. And so long as states are around, there's going to be somebody trying to use them to advance themselves. So I think they're very dangerous. But I'm actually confident that, I mean, I don't want to sound like Karl Marx here, but I guess I do sound like Karl Marx when I say I think it's going to wither away in time. It will wither away just because it's not useful for the purposes of human flourishing. States just aren't useful for that purpose. And we like useful things, you know, we do. And we don't like useless, costly things. And that, to me, is a good summary of what the state really is.
So the headline for this is Jeffrey Tucker, Marx was right. All right. Okay. So there you go. let's put a bow on it.
The alt-right who already claims that I'm a cop. Right.
Of course. All right. Just for people who don't know, tell them a little bit about fee.org and what you do there.
Yeah. Fee.org. I'm running fee.org. I'm the director of content. It's the largest reach of any liberty-oriented website outside of Reason. Reason.com, actually. We're really, really doing extremely well. We were founded in 1946 to be a kind of a light, you know, unto the world, you know, to preserve classical liberalism. And I'm just really proud of the technology we're using right now, reaching more people than ever, a couple million users a month, you know, at this stage. And I write every day. I've got something on fee.org, but we run probably 10 articles a day. So, and we're publishing ever more books and exciting things happening at Fee. I'm really pleased by it. So if you can read us, support us, share us, that'd be wonderful.
Yes. And as a voracious reader, I can attest to the fact that you write constantly because I can't even keep up with it all. So but it is always fascinating, always thought-provoking. Jeffrey Tucker, we're going to link, obviously, to Bit by Bit and also a lot of other articles that I think would be relevant to today's conversation. So I hope people will check that out. They will be in the show notes for the conversation. Jeffrey Tucker, I'm going to twist your arm to get you back on in the future to talk about this right Hegelian mess, but thank you for sharing your thoughts on the P2B solution today.
My pleasure. Thank you.